It's the TEH Podcast, episode number 245, with Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com. This week, podcasting with AI and YouTube, Genmojis, Quishing, and more.
And how's it going, Gary? How's life in Denver these days?
Good. How's life in the Pacific
Northwest? We are finally seeing some sunshine. I'm going to be taking a little bit of a trip here in a few days, which I'll talk about later. But it looks like the roads are going to be clear, and I'm actually going to be able to see where I'm going.
Excellent.
It's funny. I was listening, before we started recording, before we started the show, I've been listening to a couple of podcasts, AI-related, and one of them has been doing sort of some of the things that we've done. You may remember, months ago, I took my voice and your voice and former co-host Randy's voice and threw the recordings of each of us at 11 Labs. Mm-hmm. And then used that to train 11 Labs so that it could then say whatever we wanted it to say in whomever's voice we wanted it to be. At the time I did that, they suggested that you upload, say, a maximum of, say, 10 minutes. Anything more than that was probably going to be a waste. And it did a pretty respectable job. If I remember right, I'd have to go back and look and see what episode it was. But there are some examples of 11 Labs speaking in my voice and in your voice, and it actually coming across pretty reasonable. The podcast I was listening to actually this morning, The AI Fix, it's called. Mm-hmm. They actually did an on-air test. One of the hosts tested the other in doing essentially exactly the same thing. 11 Labs has apparently progressed dramatically. And I say that because not only will they now take, hey, give us a couple of hours of voice so that we can train our model for your voice. If you don't know that one of these might be AI, a side-by-side comparison, it's almost impossible to tell the difference. It was spooky how realistic the AI-generated voice of one of the co-hosts was. I just thought that was fascinating. We're still using 11 Labs for our explicitly synthetic announcer at the beginning and the end of the show. Mm. But it's funny, clearly this is one of those cases where one of the co-hosts of that podcast does the post-episode editing, like Connie does for this podcast. And he had admitted he's using 11 Labs to replace his co-host's voice when there's kind of a trip up, like when something gets stepped on or isn't said properly or whatever. I've never noticed. And it's a great use for that. But anyway, I just thought it was absolutely fascinating that things continue to progress and that AI, you just can't trust AI voices anymore.
I've heard of filmmakers or documentary filmmakers also using it. Particularly if you have a long interview with somebody and maybe some of the sound isn't great, but you've got a really good piece of sound, like a really good quote, like something mm-hmm. they say, but mm-hmm. oh my God, there's a horn honking outside right in the middle, something like that. That what they've been able to do is, well, they have a huge sample of the person's voice,
right?
Put it into 11 Labs, regenerate that quote, what they said, as a way to clean it up.
Right.
And then even at some point, I think documentary filmmakers are so careful about things that they even then present that to the person and say,
sure.
Here's the original, and you can hear how it sounds messed up. I generated this using AI. It sounds just like you. Is that okay? And then the person is usually like, well, yeah, I mean, that is what I said. So, and it does sound like me. So sure.
I think that there's a lot of, I'm sure that it runs the gamut from people who are just cavalierly doing it without asking mm-hmm. to people who are, getting permission beforehand to say, hey, if we need to, can we use synthetics to replicate your voice or whatever? But the concern that I have, and I've actually, I think I trying to remember. I think I've gotten an article or two on it. It's certainly an issue that I think a lot of people need to be aware of, is that scammers are using this technology as well.
Yeah,
They
I've
are,
heard
yeah, they're
that. I
using
mean,
it to basically simulate the voice of someone you know. It
yeah.
implies that they've gotten enough of that voice to make a simulation, but they're then doing the simulation in real time and then trying to scam you over the phone.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern, but for people worried about that kind of thing, I mean, I think we always have to separate very targeted scamming versus mass scamming. The idea is you could definitely use something like that if you target somebody. It's like, I'm going to simulate the voice of somebody they know and pull this whole scam on that particular person. I'm going to take the time and effort. I'm going to set this up. I'm going to do all this and target that person. But most of the scams, the vast majority of scams are not like that. They're just trying thousands and thousands of people to try to get like one person to send them a bunch of iTunes gift cards.
It's interesting though, because the barrier to doing this, it used to be really, really hard. Now, if you've got 10 minutes of your target's daughter
Yeah,
speaking on
that's hard to
Instagram
get.
or something like that, on
I mean, that's
social
all.
media, it's not that uncommon.
No.
It's not everybody, but there definitely are individuals who are spending a lot of time on social media, recording video, speaking on video, that the scammers have a lot to choose from, and it's just not that hard anymore to
Right.
do it.
It's still targeted though. It's still like there
Well,
has to be a
yeah.
human saying I'm doing it. It's not like I want to have a computer run this scam 1,000 times or
Correct.
10,000 times for me tonight, wake
Yeah.
up tomorrow morning and find out I've got a bunch of like money in my Venmo account or something like that.
There's the other
It
side of it
doesn't look
too,
like
is that,
that.
if I'm getting scam calls from my daughter, I know that it's a scam call because there is no daughter.
No, it's yeah, it's definitely going to be a bigger problem for people that could be targeted, but it's not quite to the point where it could be mass rolled
Yeah.
out. So,
In other podcasting news, I've been experimenting with this very podcast. I heard some time ago that the biggest podcast publishing platform is, of all places, YouTube, which, when I heard that, surprised me, because you don't think of YouTube as being podcast platform at all. It's a video platform. But when you think about how difficult it is to publish pure audio on a platform, on any of the platforms, what do? You turn it into video. So if you're going to turn it into a video, then you publish it on YouTube. Anyway, it is, and we are there now too. I've started taking the episodes after Connie has done her magic and published them to our website and podcast feeds, and slapped our logo on there, and played a little bit with, of all things, DaVinci Resolve. There's a bunch of tools that will take an audio with spoken word and generate a transcript or captions or whatever you'd like to call it. DaVinci Resolve will do it and burn it into the video when you generate the video, and it's amazing what that software can do. And I've been having a lot of fun with that. CapCut is another one that does something similar. DaVinci Resolve is more generic video editing software, but it definitely does a lot of these neat things. So anyway, I've been having fun with that. So anyway, there'll be a link in the show notes for those of you who are YouTube focused. Unfortunately, you can't just drop a YouTube podcast link into your podcast player of choice. Your podcast player needs to be YouTube, or I think YouTube Music. But there is a playlist at the TEH podcast YouTube feed that is the podcast eventually. So anyway, thought I'd mention that.
Cool. It's just probably a convenience thing. People just are used to they're at YouTube. Maybe this a search thing. They come up with stuff. People have playlists, and a lot of people do listen to music
Yes.
through YouTube. So makes sense.
Yeah.
And
It's
probably
funny,
really.
since I have YouTube Premium, I also have YouTube Music included with that. And I find YouTube Music frustrating. And I say that in part because the app for YouTube Music is probably the worst music playing app that I'm aware of. Things like Spotify and Amazon Music and so many of the others. I don't play with iTunes with Apple Music, obviously, but they've got good interfaces. Searchability, findability is really easy. I just get frustrated with YouTube Music all the time. However, everything's there if you know where to look.
Right.
It's pretty incredible. Everything is somewhere on YouTube, and if it's music on YouTube, it's music on the YouTube Music app as well.
Cool. Here's an interesting story, sticking with kind of AI, but maybe the other side of it. Apple, of course, is a little different than the other AI companies, is that they're trying to remain focused on privacy. And there are two ends to privacy when it comes to AI. One is when you're using AI like ChatGPT, how private are your prompts? Like, is that being shared anywhere? How well protected is that? But the other end to it is privacy that involves people that aren't even using AI. It's the privacy of your information out there, what's being used to train the AI models. And it's interesting to note that some of the biggest players in AI, like Meta, like Google, and like the site formerly known as Twitter, all have tons of content generated by people over the years that they could draw on for training their models. So how does Apple do this? Because Apple, first of all, doesn't have its own big like social media, and search engine content like that. And the other thing is Apple's saying, oh, we're going to be, privacy based. So if they actually went and said, oh, we're just going to take all the information from Google or wherever, then that would kind of be going against their own privacy rules. So they have come up with a variety of different techniques to try to train their models. And what's in the news yesterday, kind of a minor thing, but Apple announced it themselves. They said, here's some things we're doing to better train our models while still keeping privacy. And I'll link to the article because it's a really interesting article. Differential privacy aggregate trends. Anyway, it's using two methods. One is this, I think, is interesting because of this randomization method that they're using. Basically, they're using it for generating Genmoji, where you want an emoji character that doesn't exist, so you describe the emoji character, and it gives you an emoji character that fits the description. So they're usually just a few words, and Apple is basically needs to train it, but the problem is they can't train it unless they know what people are creating. So what's useful to Apple is what are people wanting from Genmoji? If we knew that, then we could test it and make sure it's creating good Genmoji. And if it's not, we could maybe give it more images of, hearts or flags or faces or whatever. But it can't do something like, oh, let's just get everybody's searches for Genmo. When they type a Genmoji, let's send that back to Apple servers. So then we can have a list and see what the most popular ones are. Because the idea is, well, privacy, right? You type something, I want a Genmoji that's a smiling face or something. That shouldn't be shared with anybody. So Apple has this randomization thing. So they come up first with a term that they think might be used for generating Genmoji, like smile, right? And they want to test it out to see how popular the term smile is. So what they do is they send it out to all the iPhones and Macs and iPads. Now you have to have your like share data thing turned on for this. Help us improve our stuff thing turned on. So all the people that have that turned on, they all their devices get like this word smile. And basically, your device then goes and says, okay, let me look at the Genmoji that have been created. Has this word been used? And if it has, then report back that yes, smile has been used. Now, of course, the privacy problem is there. Then they know, oh, you tried to make a Genmoji with the word smile in it. They're doing the normal things where they anonymize it. So, in other words, it comes back positive saying, yes. You did search for the word smile, but I'm going to immediately forget who you are, what IP address this came from, whatever. I'm just going to add a one to the smile list, and that's it.
Smile
But it go,
counter.
but the, yeah, smile counter, and then they could see how popular word is. But Apple goes one step further than this, because all that so far, that's not very fascinating. That's easy to do, right? Here's the fascinating part. Apple randomizes this by actually falsifying the information a bit. So I read it, and I think a good way to explain this technique is imagine if the answer is yes, use the word smile. instead of sending back a yes, a positive, it's going to 90% of the time send back a yes, and 10% of the time say no. The word smile was not used. It's going to lie some of the time,
Okay.
which means that if the data is ever intercepted, the yes or no means nothing because it could be lying, could be false.
Okay.
So imagine, let's go further because 90% is a lot, right? Let's say it's 60%. Let's say the word smile is used 60% of the time, it's going to send back a true, and 40% of the time, it's going to send back a false. If the word smile is not used, 60% of the time, it sends back a false, and 40% of the time, it sends back a true.
Okay.
If the information that positive is intercepted between you and Apple, it's not very useful. It's showing that there's a tiny bit more of a chance that you
Right.
did actually use the word smile. But if you want to know, it's useless. It's like that could almost just as likely be that. But if you think of the flood of data of thousands, 100,000 of these coming in to Apple, the 60% means that there's going to be a bulge in the data. The data is going to be much more positive for the word smile than, say, for the word frown, right? Because not as many people are using frown. So it's going to be, the other 60% for false and 40% for true. So they can tell, looking at all that data, that yes, the word smile is one of the most popular words used,
Right.
even though the data they're getting is very, it's kind of noisy, is what they're calling it, very noisy. And this kind of makes sense if you think about how statistics work and just polling. Like if you poll one person, that data is really useless. You have to poll like 300 people or 1,000 people to actually get good data. And it's the same thing here. You're making the data really noisy. You're making that one bit of data coming back useless. And even if you intercepted that piece of data, it's still pretty useless because it may just be wrong. But enough people, thousands and thousands of responses, and you see a pattern in the data, and you could see which words are really used. So Apple can actually get this, even though your iPhone or whatever is lying to Apple almost half the time
Most.
about it. It's fascinating to me. It's an interesting way to not to anonymize the data and also make the data so noisy that a single interception is useless.
It's
But
interesting because I think the term aggregate analysis, I've used this in for years, saying, you know what, you are not very interesting. 10,000 people like you. Yeah, that's interesting. But I think that is a really, really difficult concept for people to grasp when they're concerned about my privacy, right?
I think it's pretty interesting. I mean, they're using two methods here, one of which should be good as long as you trust Apple to throw away your identifier, like
Sure.
your IP, once it gets to them. But the other one even works even if you don't trust Apple to throw that away. Of course, if you're at that point and you say, I don't trust Apple to actually implement what they said, then,
Exactly.
there's all of that. But at least Apple can hold this up and, perhaps it could even be tested in the field in many different ways. Now, there's a second way that it's done for more complex things like actual prompts. So prompt doing an AI prompt or just asking Siri something, or even in this case, the example they gave was an automatic response. Somebody texts you and you already get like this thing where you can respond with one tap, if it's obvious what like it might be. Apple goes and looks at the real prompts, the real things people type in response, and wants to mimic those. They kind of can make a guess, and they already are making a guess that somebody would phrase a response in this way, but they want to get better at it. But how to anonymize that? Because if they actually take a real response from a person, send that back to Apple, they've got that real response. So instead, they're doing something similar where they're saying, okay, we're going to generate three responses based on like the question, what do you want to do for dinner tonight, or something like that. And we're going to generate three possible responses, send those to different devices. And it's not going to look at the specific words, like the nouns. Like imagine saying, I think the example they gave is, would you like to play tennis tomorrow? The word tennis isn't important. It's soccer, it's football, it's whatever it is. It's the rest of the sentence, the structure, saying, would you like to play some sort of sport tomorrow? And they send three variations. And if you happen to use one of those three variations in a different way, would you like to play backgammon tomorrow? It will go and get that as a positive that, oh, one of our three was actually used, and do the same anonymous, noisy thing, sending it back. And then it does that enough times, it can go and say, okay, out of these three ways to ask that question, way number two was used more often. That's the more popular one that people actually type. And so that's kind of interesting. It's using AI to train AI in some ways, because the AI is used to generate the suggestions. But I think then the idea could be that if number two is suggested, then at some point variations of number two can be suggested. And then some point after that, whatever the winner of that is, variations of that can be suggested. And you could get better and better. And that the real data of what humans actually type to ask that kind of question will eventually kind of make its way as the real suggestion. And not something that is awkwardly phrased because an AI created it.
Fascinating because there's so much you can do when you have a large enough sample size.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's exactly what
That's, yeah,
Apple's
they're using it
relying
to their
on.
advantage.
Yeah, and then they just set up processes to run these, so they don't have to come up with all of these. They can just have basically the AI constantly, making itself a little bit more accurate in how it phrases things. Also, they could come back with like, here are, some Genmoji based on what people popularly put in for Genmoji. And then, they can even have AI go and say, which one of these are kind of awkward, and then put a list of like, oh, would you ask for like a frowny face with a thumbs down or something? These don't look great, So let's go and play with the model and maybe make that look better, and then we'll get better results instead of trying to make all sorts of things look better that already look good, that already producing good results. So anyway, some cool stuff, and just showing how Apple is trying to overcome its problem of being private and trying to get an AI better and better
I love that
against
they're
all these
doing
others.
this. And you know me, I trust that they're doing this. But I think something you said earlier is that, if you don't trust them to do that, you don't trust them to do this, if you just don't trust them, none of this helps, right? The reason it's frustrating for me is that I have a lot of feedback from a class of reader who absolutely refuse to use, I'll just say OneDrive, Microsoft specific, because they are absolutely convinced that Microsoft is pushing OneDrive as hard as it is because they want to analyze your documents. They want to use your information to train their AI. And how do you prove a negative, right? How do you prove that they're not doing that? Well, you can't. And it's frustrating. Mostly because I don't believe they are, and they claim they're not, of course. But even if they did things such as, what Apple is doing, we just described Apple as doing, nobody'd believe them anyway.
Yeah, I think people perceive the value of doing something like that is far greater than it is compared to the risk to Microsoft or Apple or
Of
whoever.
course,
I
right?
mean, the risk of getting caught and
Yes.
finding out that yes, oh, all of your Microsoft OneDrive documents have been, used to build this AI model. That's a huge risk, and they have other ways of getting data to train AI, including just having people write stuff. I mean, there are people that, I know for coding, there are like people that are paid to actually just code and solve coding problems so that AI can use that to train itself to create
Yes.
better code. And
Fascinating.
the same thing for writing, I assume. Plus, there's tons of public domain works and tons of probably libraries and examples of writing that they can get access to, legitimately with, licenses paid for, signed, agreements made, all that kind of thing. it's just be weird if Microsoft will be like, oh, we can make this process 3% better by risking everything. You know, it's like, why?
Right. Change of topic. I learned a new word this week. Quishing. We've heard, of course, of fishing and smishing and a few other ishings. Quishing is an attempt to mislead using QR codes. And as it turns out, misleading QR you using QR codes to mislead is really, really easy to do. The scenario that is used as an example is very often these days you may find a QR code on a parking meter as the gateway to pay for your parking.
Oh, good one.
And of course, you know, 9 times out of 10, 99 times out of 100, that's exactly the right thing. It goes to the payment processor, does all the things. But it can be maliciously overridden with a sticker
Yeah.
that has a QR code on it that then leads you to a website that looks like the parking place, or looks convincingly enough like a parking place to actually take your money. So not only do you not do they do you not give your money to the right person, but all of a sudden your car gets ticketed because you didn't pay your parking even though you thought you did. But that's just an example. There's a lot of places where QR codes are in the wild, in public, and in a way that is easy to, like I said, put a sticker over them. I think what a lot of people don't understand is that there's really nothing special about a QR code. A QR code is just text. That it happens to 99 times out of 100 contain a URL that your QR code scanning app knows to do something with, like knows to hand it off to your browser to go somewhere. That's more of a coincidence and a convenience than it is a design. I've got an article, What is a QR Code? Where I've got the Gettysburg Address, the whole thing in a single QR code. It's like I said, it's just text. The problem is that you and I can't read a QR code. We don't know where it's going just by looking at it. And as it turns out, not all QR code scanning apps are great at previewing what it is you're about to go to. And a lot of people that use QR codes, I'll say, misuse them by using URL shorteners like Bitly or others, so that not only do you not know where the QR code is going, even if you can see the URL that the QR code represents, you still don't know where it's going because it's going through a URL shortener. So, anyway, I just wanted to bring up a new word, quishing, and have people be a little bit more skeptical. When it comes to scanning random QR codes, one of the things that I did do for myself is I confirmed that my on-device security software, which in my case is Bitdefender on my Android phone, it actually is monitoring not QR codes and not necessarily even URL shorteners, but it is monitoring the URLs that my browsers are going to go to. So it is watching for known malicious URLs before they actually get processed. But that's about the best we can do right now. QR codes are great. I use them. I love them. They're wonderful. But they do require just a little bit of extra attention and caution in the wild. So I just like the word quishing.
It is, and it's interesting scam there. Of course, one of the things about it is that it can happen just as easily with a URL. I mean, because it's the same thing. So you could have somebody could put a sticker over a parking meter that has a QR code that goes to their site, and underneath it has, you know, some URL like paypark75
Right.
dot, you know, whatever. And that URL there, if you were to type it in, it doesn't protect you at all. The QR code and the URL go to the same place.
Right.
They've replaced both. I have a hard time. I have a lot of people because I have videos on how to do QR codes, how to make them. Because there's a way in shortcuts on your Mac to make it. And the problem I've got is I hate when I see QR codes that are obviously generated by a free QR code generator that puts a little image in the middle. Like I think Google's does it. It puts a little image so you can identify the QR code as being created by Google.
Okay.
And it's just a little, it doesn't hurt anything. The
Okay.
URL is still just the URL. They're just putting a little picture there. But I'm like, you don't need to go to a free, QR code generator that is then going to put a little image or promote itself in some way. You
Yeah.
can go to Apple has a little thing in the Shortcuts app where you can create a QR code and it's completely generic. There's nothing in the QR code saying Apple or that it was generated this way. It's just the text. So I show people how to use that, but then I get lots of comments from people that don't understand that all it is a representation of text, and they want to know how do I get it to be number one, dynamic. Like I want to create a QR code, but I want it to point to a different URL later on. Like I want it, if I change my website or whatever, and I have to explain to them, it's just like a URL. It doesn't work like that. Like you have to create the web page, add a URL, and then this is a representation of that text. The other thing I get is people without any kind of website, they want it to represent something else. Can I make a QR code so that when somebody scans it, it downloads this PDF? Like, well, yes, but you have to have a web server. You have to put the PDF there,
PDF
and then
has
you
to
have to have the
go.
QR code be the URL to that PDF. It can't just be a PDF. Like the QR code can't somehow encode the PDF unless it's a massive QR code. Technically, I guess it could. But it is interesting how people don't understand. It is just, it's like the easiest way to explain it's another language. Like if you were to write a sentence in English and then write the sentence in French, it's the same thing as writing a sentence in English and then the sentence is a QR code. It's a different language that nobody could speak. It has to be decoded by the computer. Although you can actually decode it manually if you really want to go to the trouble. If you want a fun way, or maybe not so fun way, to spend a Saturday afternoon, you can look up how to do it, and there are websites that explain it. And then, it's basically kind of like doing a Sudoku, but even less fun.
It's funny. It amazes me how much redundancy is in
Oh yeah.
QR codes. You can like lose, depending on decisions made when the QR code is created, you can lose like half the QR code and it still works. I wanted to touch back real quickly on dynamic
Yeah.
destinations, because it's totally possible.
Oh, yeah, with a redirect.
Exactly. It's not the QR code that is dynamic. It's the
Yeah.
destination of the
Right.
QR code that is itself dynamic. Now, this is ever so slightly frustrating for me because some browsers actually will let you create a QR code of the current, whatever's in the current address bar.
Yeah.
Right. So you go to a web page, you do something. I think Edge has it built in. It says, make me a QR code of this, which is great, except depending on how you got there. It's way long. It's got tons of tracking information encoded in it permanently. That, by definition, then becomes invalid because it's not tracking what it was tracking originally anymore. So it still requires this step of saying, make sure you are encoding what you want to be encoded. Redirection comes into that because, for example, the nonprofit that I work with, we have, organization.org/donate. That's not the page. The page is something much longer that has a lot of other information in the URL. So if you actually go to the donate page, that's not the page you want to create a QR code of. You actually have to take a step back and create the QR code of this shorter version. But yes, reader or dynamic is very, very possible. It's just not the QR code, like you said.
A small note here because I've mentioned the TV show Mythic Quest a few times on this podcast. It's a Apple TV Plus series. It's had 4 seasons, and it's about a video game company. It's a sitcom about a video game company, and it's thought of as pretty good. I loved it and all. It's canceled, and it's 4 seasons and it's canceled. No big deal. What's interesting is it was canceled after the 4th season just ran. And there's a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of the end of the last episode of the 4th season. And the creators didn't want to leave it like that. So with permission from Apple, they redid the ending. And that's going to be released later this week. There'll be a revised edition of the last episode. I highly suspect it is not like they took the last 5 minutes away and replaced it with something else. I will bet anything it is going to be the same episode, and then they'll tack on 2 minutes. You know, do something where suddenly it jumps forward in time 10 years
Oh,
and
right.
just
Yeah.
see, you know, the what how that cliffhanger kind of resolved itself and where the characters, something like that. I don't think they would actually change the ending. I think they're going to add a few minutes to it. This is the same show that's done a bunch of different things, like when the after the first season, when the pandemic hit, they jumped on it really early and did an episode where everybody was isolated. So they sent iPhones to all the different characters, had the writers write a script. Each actor got in their home an iPhone and a script.
Remember you're
And
talking about that. Yes.
yeah, so they put it together. And of course, they made it like it was real life. Like they were all, you know, at stay at, you know, work from home because of the pandemic. And they did a whole episode like that. And so they like to jump on things, and they like to do kind of different experiments with it. They eat also. This is the same show that there's one episode each season that has none of the main characters at all. Like in the, I think it's the first season. I may be wrong, or maybe the second. But since it's a game development company, in the first season, I think there's an episode that goes back 20 years to the two. The couple that founded the game development company in the early days of computer games, just them working from their home, coming up with an idea for a game and all this. And those characters are long gone, as like is so often in real life. They have nothing to do with the current company, but you learn about like the how this company was founded at the very beginning. So it's a completely different style, completely different, you know, actors, everything is set up. You watch the first couple of minutes thinking, is this the right show? It's like a completely different thing. And they have one episode every season that does that. So they really have done lots of interesting things. I'm not surprised they also want to do this. Let's redo the end of the last episode and put that on there. It's a shame that it's ending, but I think it's a quality show. It had a target audience of developers and gamers that it hit perfectly, and I think they got a big audience of exactly those people. And the hope would be, like a lot of shows, that it grows beyond that, right? And gets a bigger mainstream audience. And it didn't quite do that. So everybody that watched it and wanted to watch it was really happy with the show. And everybody else didn't ever hear that it existed.
My hope is that this final episode, I've not seen it, by the way.
Yeah.
My hope is that the final episode is not the cheesy thing where, okay, they come to the cliffhanger and then they just scroll text that
Oh.
describes, you know,
No, no,
so and
based
so
on
went on
everything.
to do this and so and
Yeah,
all went on to
no,
do this.
based on that, the deal, big deal they're making about this and the people involved with the show, no, they definitely shot something. Even if they just spent their own money and just went and got everybody together for a few hours and did something with the set and shot something, they definitely put something. So it'll be interesting to see.
So last week I mentioned that I had sold my Tesla and gotten myself a Rivian.
Yeah.
I've been having fun with it. Like the Tesla before it, it is a rolling computer, or rather, several computers rolling, multiple CPUs in there for sure. One of the things we'll be doing here in the not too distant future is going on a bit of a trip. I pull a trailer, and one of the big concerns about switching to an all-electric vehicle for pulling, and not a, it's an Airstream, it's not a small trailer, is range. What's the impact on range on the gas vehicle that we've been using for the past 15 years? Mileage gets cut in half easily. It's easy, right? You know, you drive around in my Toyota Sequoia and it gets 16 to 17 miles to the gallon. And if you're pulling the trailer, it's like 8, which is a big cut. As it turns out, in theory, the Rivian will do the same. I have a maximum battery pack, which supposedly has a range of around 400 miles, which is actually pretty nifty. And when you hook up the trailer, this is where the tech comes in that just fascinates me, because I did this for the first time this afternoon. I hooked up the trailer and I drove it around the block just to make sure that, you know, all the I's are dotted and T's are crossed and we've got all the pieces we need. One of the things it does is, A, it notices you've hooked up a trailer. And after a few minutes, it tells you how much the trailer weighs, which Again, I get it. Mass, if you know the impact of the trailer on simple things like acceleration, right? The amount of energy going into the motor compared to the speed that comes out of it, kind of gives you enough data to make a rough guesstimate as to the mass of what it is you're pulling. And then it does a real-time recalculation of your range. And sure enough, my 400-mile range got turned into 198-mile range. The other thing that'll be interesting, that was just based on a trip around the block. As I understand it, that information is going to get updated in more or less real time as we're traveling. So as you know, my driving style when pulling a trailer impacts all of this, how fast you're going, what's the terrain, all that kind of stuff. So it'll be really interesting. I just thought it was absolutely fascinating that not only did it recognize it was a trailer, it did the math to figure out how heavy it was, and it did the math to infer the impact on the overall range. We'll see. I mean, talk to me in a couple of weeks. We'll see how the trip went.
No,
See how you did.
I envision you're pulling a trailer. You have to find somebody who's got a Cybertruck and have them pull a trailer, and you guys kind of race for pink slips or something like
So,
that.
yeah, no. As I understand it, if the Cybertruck tries to pull the trailer, the bumper falls off or
Well,
something.
there
So,
you go. Then you would win. It's funny. I was actually aware of Rivian pretty early because there was a TV show. You ever watch any of the shows with the actors Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman? They did a bunch of shows. The first one where they drove motorcycles across Asia, and then they drove did it
I've
across
heard of it,
Africa.
but we never
Yeah,
watched any of those.
the
Yeah.
last one they did two, and then there was a big gap, and then they did one where they drove from the tip of South America up the Pan American
Okay.
Highway, and on that one. Since it was a few years ago, they decided they wanted to do all electric. So they got two electric motorcycles, but then they needed support vehicles and they needed an electric truck, which didn't exist yet. But Rivian was starting, it was a startup. They gave them two of their prototypes and I think some engineers to go along with it. So the whole trip, they're on their bikes. The support vehicles are these two Rivian, I forget if they were pickups or, with the, they had, the SUV kind of design to them or whatever. But they went and they went. And there was actually times when I think they charged the motorcycles from the battery on the Rivian.
I believe it.
So it's interesting. And that was before you could buy one, before they actually had them out. These were like prototype vehicles that they had airlifted down to South America, and they were getting data and trying to, make them better and stuff. And it's interesting, you could just buy them now.
These are full-sized. Mine is an SUV, the R1S. It is the full-size SUV. It's the equivalent to my Toyota Sequoia, which is a full-size gas-powered SUV. The R1T is their pickup truck. But you're probably seeing more Rivians than you think because they also make the delivery trucks that Amazon is using.
Oh,
So
yes.
there's lots of Rivians, at least out here, delivering packages and pulling up to the driveway. And I'm wondering if what they were using in South America as a support vehicle might not have been one of those.
Yeah, it definitely was low pro, normal vehicle
Oh,
profile,
normal.
not the
Okay.
tall things.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, cool. I want one, but I have absolutely no use for a vehicle like
I understand. Yeah, no,
that.
I get it. And like I said, I'm downsizing. I've always want, I mean, I was thrilled with my Tesla for I was thrilled with my Tesla for 8 years. I loved all electric driving. It just made sense to replace it. What I'm really looking forward to now is the ability to replace those both cars, the Tesla, which I used for day-to-day driving, and the Sequoia, which was used for heavy lifting and pulling the
Yeah.
trailer, replacing them both with a single vehicle and
That'd
going
be
from there.
cool. Cool. All right.
Dokie. What's cool? What's
So
cool
it's
this
cool.
week?
Well, so Doctor Who is back. New season of Doctor Who started
Okay.
on in America on Disney Plus, everywhere else in the world on BBC. And they start right off with a very topical episode on AI. It's kind of interesting. Because the story It's not spoiling the story at all to say that, you know, some other planet, some distant place and time, there is a kind of an AI-based civilization that somehow, in its large language model, gets some data from Earth, which messes things up a little bit, because it doesn't understand exactly what that data represents. Well, basically, it's one of those, like, you buy somebody a star, you know, you pay money,
Yes.
send money to something, right? And then you get a certificate that says that this star is now named after them. And somehow that ends up in the AI language model on this planet, which, and it's its own star.
It
So it
becomes the
decides
star
that that
thing.
person is the queen, must be the queen. And the planet is named after, like,
Her.
named after the person and all that stuff. And there's a whole lot of different back and forth about AI in the episode. So a little commentary going on about AI, and a lot of other regular Doctor Who stuff too. It's not all just about that, but it kind of has a bit of an AI theme running through it. So, and then we've got, I guess, a season of a bunch more episodes coming out. Also, Black Mirror has a new season too, but I have not checked that out. It's interesting that Doctor Who and Black Mirror are basically debuting almost at the same time.
It's funny. So, we did watch the Doctor Who episode. We're right on the cusp of that one, and we'll be following it as they come out. Black Mirror, my wife mentioned it to me just yesterday that, we keep hearing about it. Maybe we should give it another try. I think we watched like one episode from the first season and got so depressed that it was like, no, maybe not. But yeah,
They
we'll see.
throw in a happy episode once a season just to keep you going, keep you from jumping off a cliff.
Right.
So obviously I'm gonna I've watched all the Black Mirrors, and some of them do give me nightmares. Nightmares at night, and sometimes when I think of them during the day, they give me
Yeah,
nightmares.
you see, and that's not a great recommendation for where I'm at right now.
I get you, I get you. Cool.
Have you been watching Jack Reacher?
No.
Okay. Do you know Jack Reacher from the Lee Child books? Okay. It's a season. I think he just wrapped up his third season of Jack Reacher. And we were talking about him, Jack Reacher, the actor that plays him. Richeson. Keep saying his name wrong. And we decided, okay, yeah, what else has he been up to? He's been a busy, busy guy. He's done a lot of different things. And in doing that research, we stumbled across a movie that sounded really interesting called The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, which we had never heard of it. It just came out last year.
Well, it came out. I don't even know if it came out that long ago. I think it's
And like I
pretty
said,
recent.
well, it's dated 2024 in IMDb, for whatever that's worth. But completely under the radar. It's got several familiar faces. The way that I describe it, it's a World War II story where, this team has to go and basically blow up or get access to something that would then allow Americans to make it safely across the Atlantic more often and join the war effort. It had kind of an Ocean's 11 vibe to it, where it was almost a heist caper, where you had all these different people bringing their different skills to the table and doing things all at the right time in the right way under the noses of the Germans in these very. Anyway, it was just fun. We enjoyed it, had a good time with it. Like I said, I think the amount of time between learning that the movie existed and finishing the movie and thoroughly enjoying it was something on the order of about 4 hours. So, anyway, Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. It was
Yeah,
fun.
I saw two, and I was surprised because I just was brought in by the premise. I didn't know anything about the actor. I was like, oh, premise, it seems like it might be fun. Let me start watching it. And I was instantly brought into the movie. And then after watching the movie, I was like, boy, for a movie I've never heard of that for all I know went straight to, like, being released, streaming, the quality was really high. And then, of course, the movie ends and it's a Guy Ritchie film.
Yes, I didn't, and I didn't realize that until the end either.
I'm like, oh, okay, well, that explains a lot of what I saw in this movie. It's a Guy Ritchie film. And it's funny to actually watch a Guy Ritchie film. You know, and he, for those that know, he did lots of British action movies and Sherlock Holmes movies and all that. And it was interesting to watch it without knowing it was Guy Ritchie, without being, okay, I'm going to watch a Guy Ritchie film. It's got a lot of action, a lot of cool camera shots, a lot of quick-paced dialogue. And I didn't know that. There was a lot of action, a lot of cool camera shots, a lot of quick-paced dialogue. I said, huh. And then I was like, oh, that explains it.
The other thing I forgot until the end of the movie was that it started out by saying based on actual events.
Yes.
Because at the end, they show you the photographs of the real individuals on whom some of these roles were based and what happened to them. Which
And I
kind of reminds
think,
me of my suggestion earlier about your final episode of Mythic Quest, right? There was kind of that. Here's a picture, here's what they went on to
right.
do. Here's a picture, here's what they went on to do.
And I think if you also, there's a tiny similarity between that movie and the Quentin Tarantino movie, Inglourious Basterds, which is completely fictional. But I remember when that movie came out, he said he was inspired by some individuals that were real. And I believe some of those individuals are the people in this movie. So
Oh,
this movie is like based on a true story. Inglourious Basterds is not based on any kind of true story, but inspired by people that existed. So yeah, so that's kind of why they feel similar.
anyway, it was a good time. So,
So,
where are you going to point people this week, Gary?
yeah, I'll point to a video that's out when this podcast comes out called 10 Reasons Your Mac May Be Acting Strange and How to Fix It. Just decided to do a compendium of like the things people ask me, like something's wrong, something's strange. And it's like, oh, you've turned this setting on. Turn that off. I compiled enough of them to make a whole video of 10 of those. For people to watch. And it's kind of thing that it may help you out and it may just be good to watch and kind of like keep in the back of your head that, you know, when you see it, you're like, oh, wait, this is one of those things. There's a way to fix this.
I'm sure. I mean, you've got that gut feeling too. You end up with a question, and it's like, oh yeah, that's this really obscure thing over here.
Exactly.
The one I'm going to point folks at is I use BitLocker. Are my backups encrypted? There's a lot of confusion about how whole disk encryption works and what its impact on things like backups are, and in some cases, the wrong assumption can be kind of dangerous. So I walk through exactly what's encrypted when you're using something like BitLocker, and then when you back that disk up, when is that backup encrypted? When is it not encrypted? Spoiler, most of the time it's not, but there are some scenarios where it can be encrypted by default. So it's something to be aware of. I use BitLocker. Are my backups encrypted? AskLeo.com/179503.
Okey-doke.
I think that wraps us up for another week.
Yep. Sounds good.
As always, thank you everyone for listening. And yes, hopefully you may even find us out on YouTube. No, we're not publishing the actual video of us talking to each other. It is one of those things with the, yeah, we may do that sometime. We did that for an anniversary episode years ago, if you remember. But
Yeah, there's a bunch of us that were like,
not just yet.
yeah.
It's one of those things where, okay, you know, okay, fine. I have to make myself look a little bit better before I'm willing to go on camera that way.
Yeah.
And I have to turn on my lights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But
But
anyway,
think about your
whatever.
background, all that.
All that stuff. All right. Well, there we go. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.
The show notes for this week are at thpodcast.com/teh245. If you have a comment or question for us, be sure to leave it on the show notes page. The TEH podcast is hosted by Leo Notenboom of AskLeo.com and Gary Rosenzweig of MacMost.com and edited by Connie Delaney. I'm your synthetic announcer, Adam, from 11labs.com. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you here real soon.